Welcome to Hope Talks, where we share inspiring stories of hope in Jesus Christ. Hope Talks is hosted by Pastor Margaret Michael and Grayson Willis. Join us for uplifting stories of triumph, faith, and the enduring power of Christ's love. Also, if you're in the listening area, tune in to 1470 AM or 102.1 FM WBTX to listen to Hope Talks every Sunday at noon.
Welcome to today's broadcast of Hope Talks. I'm Grayson Willis.
And I'm Pastor Margaret Michael. And today, I am so excited to have a friend and a former colleague, right, from the hospital. In those days, we worked together. Today, we have Deb Thompson with us. Deb, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. I was sitting at my dad's one day, and in my dad's last couple of years, we were always trying to find magazines and things that he would enjoy looking at, pictures and things that would trigger his memory. And so there was always interesting books around. And one day I picked up a book and it had your name on it. And so we're going to talk about that today. Excited just to hear about the work that went into this publication that I saw surrounding Silver Lake. And we're going to get to that in a little bit. But before we do, I would love to hear from you just a little bit about your family and where you grew up.
Well, I'm an original Valley girl. I actually grew up in East Rockingham.
Okay.
I went to school at Elkton High School, which doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
My family, I had a brother and two sisters. The brother was older, the sisters were younger. So I was always the one that wanted to play school and make my little sisters be the pupils. So grew up loving to read and loving to write, which kind of led to my career path. Currently, and I've always lived in this area. I've never left.
Right.
I love visiting other places, but I always love coming back here to home. I am very blessed to have a wonderful son and a fantastic daughter-in-law. And two beautiful grandkids, and Hannah, my granddaughter, and Colin, my grandson, and my bonus granddaughter, Hope.
Yes.
Who we had on about a month ago.
That's right. We had her on here recently.
Yes. Hope works here in the daycare center, and she's just a delight. And and my wonderful husband, Clayton. And so I'm just surrounded by my lovely family and feel very blessed.
Yeah. Well, we are recipients of being able to work with Hope, and we love her here. And so, thank you for sharing just a little bit about how you grew up. And what was your title at the hospital? I'm sure there was a few different titles, right?
I came to work at the hospital in 1988.
Okay.
And I was there for 33 years.
Okay.
So, yes, my job title and responsibilities transitioned through the years.
Mm-hmm.
I came in as what was called a communication specialist.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually came in working for Merv Webb, who a lot of your listeners may know. He was in charge of the RMH Foundation.
Yes.
In development for many, many, many years, and was wonderful. And he hired me, for better or for worse. And I worked with another gentleman named Lewis Saylor for a few years. And so my primary responsibilities were a newsletter, and we were developing a new full-page ad. It was called an advertorial for the newspaper. And so my job was to research what was going on at the hospital, new program, services, technology, and write about it and get it designed and illustrated and ready for the newspaper every month.
Yeah.
So the newsletter, while that sounds like something small, it actually at that time was for our internal audiences, our staff, our volunteers, and physicians. It also went to all of our donors.
Mm.
So it was internal and external. So it was anywhere from 8 to 16 pages. And so that was done every month. So there you're promoting employees and the activities of the hospital, but then also talking to external audiences about what was going on at the hospital. So it was a public relations tool as well as an internal communication tool.
Yeah. And I think that's where we met, right? At Image Recovery.
Probably when we were doing some stories about the work of the Image Recovery Center,
yes,
which was, I guess, still is such a wonderful gift to women who are undergoing cancer treatment.
Yes.
And that's how I met you. That's
yes,
right.
Yes, I just remember that is exactly how we met.
Yes.
I remember the publication that even hung in the doctor's offices. People would come, they would see me out, and they go, "You look familiar." I'm like, "Well, maybe my picture is hanging on the wall of your doctor's office."
Was that
they were
prior?
In the rooms for image recovery.
Was that pre-HealthQuest or do you think after? Because in 1995, like I said, my job kind of progressed mm-hmm. and my title progressed over time. One day my boss asked me to put together a proposal for a magazine. And this was in 1993, maybe. And I love the idea of having a magazine for yes. the hospital. It's very exciting. So I did a lot of research, you know, what would it cost? You know, what are the benefits? You know, this is an investment. So is the hospital going to get back what it, at least what it puts into it?
Right.
And it took a couple years and one boss left and another boss came in and she was very excited about the idea. And we actually had to do literally a song and dance for our president and CEO, who at the time was Carter Melton. Mm-hmm. And I think Carter may have just gotten a big kick out of it, you know, but we did it. And whether or not it was because we did a song and dance,
yes.
but he took that to the board and the board liked the idea. Mm-hmm. So we launched our HealthQuest magazine at the hospital in 1995. Mm-hmm. And it's still in existence today. So I gave birth to it and I passed my baby on and it's yeah. still thriving and serving the community today.
Yeah, I read it. I just received it in the last week or so. And so,
I just got my first issue and I saw Dr. Williams on the cover and ran into an old coworker yesterday who said she's getting knee replacement surgery with the robot, which is featured on the cover of the magazine along with Dr. Yeah. Williams. So, you know, it just makes me tingle to know that we created something because all these things are always a team effort.
Yes.
That we were able to create something that benefits the community and still serves it today. Yeah,
that was genius. We'll just say that.
So it was somebody's genius, but I always believe that God causes things to happen.
Absolutely.
And absolutely God's hand was in that work.
Yeah, he definitely. It's just amazing. Like, there was a HealthQuest article. It was after that. So I still have the magazine. So anyway.
Of course you do.
Of course
and we should all. And you should be autographing it for Pam.
Well,
it was always a big deal for people when you say, "We want to put you on the cover of the magazine." And they're like, "What?" But I think the staff got really excited when mm-hmm. we'd say, "Hey, we want to put you in the magazine and we want to do a story about this." And to them, it was never about them, but it was about what they were doing and how they were serving patients. So mm-hmm. it's just wonderful to be able to give them that gift.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that was really good. And now there is another publication.
There is.
And so I think the title is Silver Lake, 200 Years of a Shenandoah Valley Mill and Community. And Cheryl Lyon is the one that put this together. Tell us about your part in this publication.
Okay. Well, first of all, I need to say that Cheryl Lyon is a creative genius and a force of nature. Mm-hmm. She is a hardworking woman who truly believes in history and heritage and community. And if you do read the book, you'll find that Cheryl is the owner, a current owner of the mill, and
yes.
she's owned it, I believe, for between 25 and 30 years. The mill is so central in the lake to the community, to the that Dayton community. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, all of this happened before the Civil War. And then there's a rich piece of that history associated with the Civil War. And the fact that the mill was the place where people gathered in the community, where the farmers came and they brought their crops to be turned into grain mm-hmm. so that then they could be used. They would take some home to use. And then the rest would be sold. The lake is used for recreation activities and fishing, mm-hmm. as your nieces and nephews have told me.
That's right.
That live right there. But the book came about because the area was approaching its 200 years mm-hmm. of service, because the lake was actually created and the mill created then on the lake in order to serve the needs of the farmers. So Cheryl put together a committee to plan a year of bicentennial activities, and along with that, to create this book to chronicle the history of the people and the area. And I had retired or was on the verge of retiring, and I am good friends with Jean Litton and was with her husband, Alan, who was a renowned photographer here in the area. And Alan called me one day and said, Cheryl Lyon is going to be working on this book about the lake, and she's looking for some writers. And I suggested you, and I wondered if I could give you her name. And I said, well, I guess so. I don't know if I can be helpful or what I can do. I'd like to know more about the project. So he did, in fact, give her my name, and she, in fact, called me, and things kind of went from there, and her enthusiasm for the project and what she wanted to do and the folks that she wanted to be interviewed, all that just really excited me. So although I had promised my husband I wouldn't take on any big projects for the first 6 months I was retired, I said yes. And I'm so glad I did. I'm so glad I got the opportunity to work on the project and meet some amazing people.
So what, like, you weren't planning to take anything on. So what really, what was that initial interest? Like, what was the thing that you, I don't know if I can let this slip by. What was that initial?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, the thing about writing and what always drew me to journalism was telling people's stories. And people who meet me might think I'm an extrovert, but I'm actually pretty introverted. So, like, if I could just spend my days reading books and petting my cats, I'd be really happy. So I have to force myself to get out and do things. But I love talking to people one-on-one and just finding out what makes you tick. And you know, tell me about your life and how you grew up. So I've just always, I meet strangers. My husband all the time tells me, do not talk to the person in the elevator. You know, so, and I'll go, hi, how are you? So then, anyway, and by the time we get to our floor, I know everything. But so it just, I love history myself. I love heritage and community as well. So I didn't see how I could say no. I don't want to talk to these people and get their stories. So I said, I definitely want to do this. And it seemed like it would be, these were one-on-one and there weren't going to be a lot of them. So in the end, I actually did 7 one-on-one interviews and did some other pieces. Like, as you know, Margaret, I interviewed your dad and your brother. Related to compulsory education back in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yes.
So anyway, it was just, and I do think that probably God was whispering in my ear and saying, This is something you should do. This is something that would be fulfilling and would also be a blessing to the community and the families. And I have a story, one story in particular that I can share related to that.
Yeah, well, we definitely want to hear that story. Before that, though, how did you all figure out what stories? Like, how did you make the connections for the stories?
Well, that was all the genius of Cheryl. Cheryl lives there. She's lived in that community. She knows these people. She has intimate friends, particularly among the Mennonite population in that area. She's done a lot to help preserve the area, and they appreciate that so much. And she appreciates them so much. And so the people that I interviewed primarily live around the lake, and many of them have connections to the Millers through the year, who either the owners or the people who ran the mill. So that's where the names came from. Many of them were older, so their stories, if they weren't collected, could have been lost.
It is a rich read.
Some of the thoughts that I have as you were talking, you talked about, you know, people think you're an extrovert, but you're an introvert, that you like the one-on-one conversation. Well, I can so relate to that, because before the broadcast, you asked me how I got into doing this, and I studied broadcasting in college, and it didn't come natural at first, but my professor said, don't think about everybody listening on the radio. Think about it like a one-on-one conversation. And so that's the power of one-on-one conversation. Also, as we're talking about Silver Lake, I actually have a picture in my house of Silver Lake that my dad took. And before he was in the ministry, he was a professional photographer. So he still likes to use those skills. So I have a perfect picture of Silver Lake as we're talking about stories from Dayton and around the Silver Lake. So,
oh, gosh, that makes me tingle.
He came to the Valley to work for Gentry's photography.
Originally.
Oh, okay.
So that was the original trip to the Valley, and that's where he got connected to this church.
Wow, that's amazing.
The lake has many precious memories for me. Growing up, around Molehill, and of course, being very deeply connected to that, to the community there. And one of my favorite memories of the lake is being able to ice skate on the lake.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
That I love to ice skate. And so when the lake froze over, that was a big deal. And of course, you know, we, in my early years, Rockingham Mill was there, mm-hmm. and yes. That was, you know, a place, again, for us to get feed mm-hmm. For the animals. And yeah. So, yeah, a lot of really neat memories located around the mill.
I think it's awesome mm-hmm. that you have those memories, too.
Yeah, and I remember learning to drive in Mennonite country. Dad would take me out there because there wasn't very many cars, so it was, yeah, so I remember.
Yeah.
But you had to be careful around.
Yeah, yeah. You had to pull off the side of the road if there was a horse and buggy or something.
Your dad knew what he was doing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took the girls there to fish. And, like, yeah, we have many memories around the lake.
Well, there's stories in here. Several people mentioned the ice skating and how lovely it was to see the kids that would get out on the lake in the winter and ice skate. So the kids loved it. And the older folks loved watching the kids skate.
Oh, yeah, never thought about that.
Yes, yes. So many people said, oh, I just love watching the kids come out to ice skate.
Is there anything that you could share with us just in those interviews, moments where as you were having those conversations, doing those interviews, that was a huge aha about history, the history of our community, something that would have been lost, something that has really made an impact to the magazine?
Wow. There were so many profound things, honestly. I interviewed one lady that was 103 years old.
Wow.
And unfortunately, she has since passed. Mm-hmm. But her story was amazing about literally going, having to walk up an icy hill to school. So many people walked to school. Yeah. And a lot of the Mennonite school, there were small schools all around the area. And if you think back, there weren't, it was hard to get to school. They didn't have busing and things, you know, until what, the 50s right. or something like that. So a lot of kids walked to school. Mm-hmm. And so these kids, particularly the Mennonite children, there were little schools dotted all around. So nobody had to walk more than a few miles. Mm-hmm. So if I asked somebody, well, how far did you have to walk to school? Oh, 2 or 3 miles. And no matter who it was, they say, oh, about 2 or 3 miles. And these were not people that all went to school in the same place at the same time. So I thought that was really interesting. Many, many people walked to school. There was no heat in the school except for like a coal stove. Mm-hmm. And you carried your lunch in your lunchbox. And one day, the one lady that I interviewed, she said she was little. She was walking up the hill, and she lost her lunchbox. And she had to slide back down the hill to get her lunchbox. Mm. Because if she hadn't, she wouldn't have had any lunch that day. She also told me about eating walnut and butter sandwiches, which you can't pay me to eat a black walnut because it's just not my favorite.
A little too bitter.
But it's a big, big deal around that area. Apparently, there's certain kinds of walnut trees that have grown for years and years. And so anyway, their snack when they got home from school was homemade bread with butter and cracked black walnuts. And there's a treat you can try if
yes.
you want to.
We never had. We did not do cracked walnut sandwiches, but we had plenty of black walnuts.
But yeah, and still today,
yes.
because I know there are people who bring them to Cheryl. Another lady that I interviewed whose story was very special, and well, I'll just tell you the story. One thing that really fascinated me was the feed sacks, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you know a lot about the feed sacks.
I do.
But back in the day, the feed sacks were printed cotton fabric.
Yes.
Beautiful colors and patterns. And you think, well, why would a feed sack have a pattern? Because it's just going to have feed in it. You know, a lot of them are stamped with the name of the feed mill.
Yes.
And not just here, but everywhere. But anyway, but people use them, not just Mennonites, but people use them to make dresses and clothing. And the one lady I interviewed showed me a little gown that she'd made for her daughter when her daughter had to go to the hospital when she was 5 years old. And her daughter's now in her 70s. Mm-hmm. And she showed me the soft little gown that she made for her daughter out of a feed sack. And it was, they printed juvenile patterns, they printed bright patterns, florals, gingham, whatever you can imagine. And so the feed mill wasn't producing just a product for the farmers, but also for the farmers' wives and children. Mm-hmm. And one gentleman told me that his mother said to him, when you go down to the feed mill, find me 3 feed sacks in the same pattern, because she knew she wanted to make a dress or something, and she needed 3 mm-hmm. feed sacks with the same pattern in order to make it. That's right. But there were curtains, gowns, dresses, shirts, tea towels, tablecloths, anything you could imagine was made from the feed sacks. And thankfully, a lot of those things still exist, and Cheryl has quite a number in her collection.
Yeah. So I had feed sack dresses. I got to pick the print.
Did you?
Yes, oh, yes. Awesome. This, you've unlocked a core memory for me.
I'd like to see those pictures.
Yeah, if there was, but there weren't pictures. Mm-hmm. But I still have, I have one feed sack. It's a beautiful blue floral. I have to show it to you. But yeah, I do have that. So yes, I'm very familiar. And Mom had a stack of them. And I could go in and, you know, find, if we had enough of, you know, one. When I was smaller, we could make them.
Yes, because they had, they knew. They knew how many they needed. Mm-hmm. She knew what size you were. Yeah. And how to make her pattern. I had a connection to feed sacks because when I was a kid, and I grew up near Elkton, there was Elkton Milling Company. And I don't know that if this is where my mother got feed sacks, but she embroidered, and she embroidered tea towel sets and pillowcase sets. And she used the feed sacks. And when you say feed sack, you think of something rough and scratchy and ugly. But these were, I guess, a kind of a cotton muslin-y. You washed them, and they were soft and beautiful. And, you know, bleached them if they were off color or whatever. Yeah. And she would make the most beautiful embroidered sets. Yeah. And so that was my connection with them. But when I started working with the mill and I saw everything that Cheryl had and talked to the different people I talked to, it was just incredible. Mm-hmm. The one lady I spoke with, Veda Rhodes, this was amazing. Veda was 93. But in her younger days, she had crocheted. Everything was kept. Everything was used. Mm-hmm. She and her sisters kept the strings that tied the sacks. She kept them and rolled them into balls. And then she decided one day she was going to make something from these strings. She crocheted, and it's there's a picture in here. She crocheted a like a bedspread or a sofa cover out of those strings.
Oh, my goodness.
This beautiful pattern out of these strings. I mean, the creativity just blows your mind.
Yes. So nothing was wasted.
No. No, everything was used, and there was no such thing as idle hands.
That's right.
So whatever you had, you were kind of obliged to try to do something with it.
Yeah, speaking of that, it brings to mind, we would keep our bread bags, and Mom would weave rugs. And so we had, you know, like a rug that was woven out of old bread bags.
Yes, yes.
Like everything was used.
I have heard of that, and I probably in my youth, because my grandparents were my mother's parents, her family, but they were very, I shouldn't say very country, but they lived back in the hills, kind of, and they did the same thing. You used everything you had, and she, no matter what it was, she'd make something out of it. But I remember the bread bag rugs. What a wonderful way. I mean, if we were doing that today, we wouldn't have them all in the landfill, right?
That's exactly right. That's so true. Yeah. So what has the feedback in the community been like from your book?
Oh, gosh. Cheryl would be the best person to ask that question. But I do know that there have been 2 reprintings of the book. So the original print run, and I venture a guess, I don't know if it was 2,000, 2,500. I'm not sure. So don't anybody hold me to that. But I do know that there were 2 more printings of the book. And so I think that overall the community reception of the book has been very positive, and especially the families and the generations of the families who were connected. Going back to Veda Rhodes, the one lady that I interviewed, and she had lived in the mill house, which your brother and his wife live in now?
My niece.
Your niece
my
and
niece,
her husband.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
My brother's daughter.
That's
right,
Dale's daughter.
Yes. Sheila.
Yes. She had lived in that house. And then when her husband retired from farming, they moved to the little brick house up the road where she could see the ducks and feed the ducks every day. But so Veda, Veda's family, she never had any children of her own, but she married Mr. Rhodes, and he had two daughters, mm-hmm. and subsequently their sons and their mm-hmm. children. So, she said, they all embraced me and made me feel just like mm-hmm. I was one of the family. Well, I interviewed Veda on it was a Thursday, but she had just had a birthday, and the whole family came in. And all of the grandchildren, the children, all the relatives were there. And she had a big house full of people. And she was so happy that they had come to celebrate her birthday. And then I had come and interviewed her and talked with her. And so a few days after that, I got an email from Cheryl. And she said, I wanted you to know this before you see it in the paper. Mm-hmm. But Veda passed away.
Wow.
And I just shivered because I had had the opportunity to interview her and talk about things from her youth and how important the horses were and how her dad made a blanket out of when their horse finally passed, he had to put the horse down. He made a blanket out of the horse's skin so they could go to church under that blanket, and all these things that the family really didn't know or weren't aware of. And I use a tape recorder when I tape. So for people that are thinking, well, how do I do this? Well, in the old days when you did reporting, you had to write it all down.
Mm-hmm.
But with the advent of tape recorders and phone recorders,
yes.
you can, it's very right, easy, yeah. thank the good Lord, yeah. to interview. And so it's easy to keep, you know, make sure you get the facts right. And also to hear the voices, and the voices are so important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had done that interview, and we ended up sharing that with her family.
Wow.
And Cheryl said it just brought them to tears that we were able to talk to her and get her voice and capture her stories. So that was really, really special to me that we were able to do that for her family.
Yeah, it was more than just capturing a story mm-hmm. for an article. This was gaining knowledge, context of a family that right. they would have lost within a couple of days.
Right.
Possibly things that they didn't know or hadn't heard or maybe would have, like you say, would have gotten lost. And it's almost like, if you think about not as big, the Foxfire books that were done, there was these college professors back in the 60s or whatever that went into Appalachia and gathered all the stories of how the people did everything from butchering hogs to
yes.
making apple butter and all of that. And this is kind of, I think, has a little bit of a flavor of that through the stories. But in terms of the community, I know Cheryl, I had the opportunity to be involved with two presentations, one at the Rocktown History mm-hmm. Museum with Cheryl, not too long after, around the time of the publication, I think. And then Cheryl was unable to speak to a donor group, I think it was, at Bridgewater Retirement Community maybe it was earlier this year. Anyway, and Cheryl had some health issues, and so I was able to go and talk to them, and they were really fascinated. So I think well-received. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes books about history, they really show their true worth later on
mm-hmm.
With generations that say, oh, yeah, I want to know more about mm-hmm. that, or I want to mm-hmm. learn about that. And so that may be preserving. The important part is preserving the story for the generations to mm-hmm. come.
Yeah, and there is a rich history that you all were able to capture. And as I have been thinking about that, I'm thinking about how your earlier profession prepared you for this when you retired. Like, this is what you did.
That is what I did. Oh, I loved, like, I did the stories. I cut my teeth. I got a little bit of experience in journalism working in a newspaper and then realized I don't like the life of a newspaper reporter.
Mm-hmm.
God bless them. That's a hard job, even harder probably mm-hmm. in the old days, but I know hard now too. But I wanted to tell people stories. That's really mm-hmm. what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. and with positivity.
Yes.
So PR became the area that I really wanted to be a part of. So with the hospital, telling the positive stories and letting the community know about the good things we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't always focus on that one bad thing that they hear. You know, there's lots of good stuff,
right.
and the people are good.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that.
Thank you for listening to today's broadcast of Hope Talks. You've been listening to part one of our interview with Deb Thompson about the book that she wrote with Cheryl Lyon titled The Silver Lake and Mill 200 Years of Stories. We pray that you'll join us for part two next Sunday at noon right here on 1470 AM and 102.1 FM WBTX. We pray that today's broadcast has been a half hour of hope for your life. May God bless.
Hope Talks is sponsored by Church of the Nazarene in Harrisonburg in partnership with Sunshine Ministries. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcast. Your feedback helps us spread hope to even more listeners. Stay tuned for more uplifting stories in the next episode. Until then, keep the faith, share the love, and find joy in the hope that Jesus Christ brings.